Early today, Chairman Henry Hyde convened the second day of President Clinton's impeachment defense at 12 minutes after 8. Hyde had given the president's legal team two 15-hour days to present its defense, but by working through lunch and keeping their questions to 5 minutes, members of the committee got through three panels of witnesses yesterday in 11 hours.
The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you.
Today's first panel asked to testify by the White House was composed of five former federal prosecutors. Thomas Sullivan, who was a United States attorney from Chicago, spoke for all of them when he said, given the evidence in the president's case, reasonable prosecutors would not bring perjury or obstruction of justice charges against him.
Responsible prosecutors do not submit cases to a grand jury for indictment based upon probable cause. They do not run cases up the flagpole to see how the jury will react. They do not use indictments for deterrence or as a punishment. Responsible prosecutors attempt to determine whether the proof is sufficient to establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Some years ago, during the Bush administration, I was asked by an independent counsel to act as a special assistant to bring an indictment against and try a former member of President Reagan's cabinet. Having looked at the evidence, I declined to do so because I concluded that when all the evidence was considered, the case for conviction was doubtful and that there were innocent and reasonable explanations for the allegedly wrongful conduct. Having reviewed the evidence here, I have reached the same conclusion. It is my opinion that the case set out in the Starr report would not be prosecuted as a criminal case by a responsible federal prosecutor.
Most notable among the five former federal prosecutors on the panel was William Weld, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts.
There's usually something else involved in a federal perjury prosecution. There's a pass-through aspect here. You're really going to something else. I once prosecuted a guy who stated that he was in Florida on November 28th and 29th, 1981. You may say, that's kind of, you know, stooping to pick up pins. Why would you prosecute him for that? Well, that was the day the city of Lynn, Massachusetts burned down, and this guy was an arsonist, and three people made him in the Porthole Pub in Lynn, Massachusetts that day. So, and we found his fingerprints on a ticket to Florida the next day after the fire. So we thought it'd be a good idea to bring a perjury prosecution there to rattle the cage a little bit, and we did. And often we brought them where we were trying to penetrate a wall of silence, as in cases of public corruption or narcotics, when you're trying to break through this omerta, everyone's got a dummy up phenomenon. But there is something else that you're trying to get at there.
A year ago, Weld was President Clinton's choice to become ambassador to Mexico, but his confirmation was blocked by Republican conservative Senator Jesse Helms. The White House might have hoped Weld's appearance today on behalf of the president would help persuade enough moderate Republicans in the House to vote against impeachment if the issue comes to the House floor.
I am pretty well convinced that adultery, fornication, or even a false denial, I'm assuming perjury here, false denial of adultery or fornication, they do not constitute high crimes and misdemeanors within the meaning of the impeachment clause of the U.S. Constitution. They're not offenses against the system of government. They don't imperil the structure of our government. The remedy of impeachment is to remove the office holder, get the worm out of the apple. It's a prophylactic remedy. It is not punitive. If any of you are thinking we've got to vote yes on impeachment to tarnish the president, he's already tarnished, and that's really not the purpose of the impeachment mechanism.
Weld concluded by recommending the Congress might want to censure the president, impose on him a substantial fine, and leave him vulnerable to criminal prosecution once he leaves office. John Conyers, the committee's ranking Democrat, applauded the testimony of all five witnesses.
What you've done here is of signal importance from my point of view. This should be studied carefully by everybody that makes public utterances about the questions of perjury and obstruction and how and when materiality figures into the prosecutorial role.
Chairman. However, most Republicans on the committee, beginning with Bill McCollum of Florida, did not accept the panel's testimony without a challenge.
You had a situation in which the President of the United States says that he did not commit or have sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky under the definition as given in the court in the Jones case. That court included in its definition explicitly the touching of breast or genitalia. Now, the president said, I didn't do that. He repeated it very carefully in the grand jury testimony. Monica Lewinsky said on 9 occasions in her sworn testimony before the grand jury, the president touched her breast, and on 4 occasions they had genital contact, and that all of this was to arouse. Now, the issue of corroboration. There are 10 corroborative witnesses. Interestingly enough, strangely enough, Monica Lewinsky talked contemporaneously with family members, friends, and relatives about these matters in great detail. And we have 10 of those whose testimony is before us in sworn testimony. 7 of the 10 corroborate the explicit detail with regard to this touching under the definition of sexual relations that Monica Lewinsky describes. Now, it seems to me that kind of corroboration is precisely the kind of corroboration that would, in fact, engender a prosecution, would give confidence to a prosecutor to take perjury cases forward, and would indeed give a high probability of conviction if this were taken before court in any court in this land. A jury would be hard-pressed not to convict under those circumstances.
I think that there's reasons why that prosecution would not win is, one, as I said in my statement, that both witnesses, including Ms. Lewinsky, had an incentive to lie, and she had an incentive to lie not only to the grand jury on this issue, but to her confidants, because otherwise she would be acknowledging an unreciprocated sexual relationship. But just as important, if you're talking about one witness that Mr. Starr or any prosecutor is going to put forward, Mr. Starr and his prosecutors himself are going to have to argue in this case that Ms. Lewinsky's testimony and other issues is not accurate. They're going to have to argue that. They're going to be in a position where they're going to have to say she's telling the truth as to this, not telling the truth as to other things.
When the president was asked at any time, were you and Monica Lewinsky together alone in the Oval Office, he answered, I don't recall. The evidence indicates that he was, in fact, alone with Ms. Lewinsky on many occasions, including the time that they exchanged gifts less than 20 days before the deposition. Mr. Sullivan, for this not to be perjury, the president must have genuinely forgot his numerous encounters with Ms. Lewinsky. Is that correct, for it not to be perjury?
Yes. The evidence in a perjury case requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant not only made a false statement, but knew it was false at the time it was made. That's correct.
And the test would be that he genuinely forgot in order for that not to be perjury. Is that correct?
That's my understanding.
Just yesterday, we were presented with the president's 184-page defense report and were told that the word alone is a vague term unless a particular geographic space is identified. Do you find that sort of legal hair-splitting defense helpful? Don't you think that we ought to at least be able to agree that alone means you're by yourself, not with anybody?
Well, I think alone, you know, in essence means that you're by yourself. But I think that while you don't forget that you had sex with somebody, I think you have to go back and look at the confusing nature of the answers. But what basically was going on, there's no question. The president was trying to as best to avoid and was playing word games in his deposition.
He shouldn't have been doing it,
and he was doing it. The issue is, what is the legal consequences now? And that's what we're all struggling with.
I know Mr. Craig is here, and I don't know whether he is delighted or dismayed by the panel today, because after promising us yesterday that we would not be hearing technicalities and legalities, that's all we hear today. And that's fine. We have a panel of very distinguished criminal attorneys here, and that is the essence of criminal law. We have lawyers here that would apparently agonize greatly over a definition of sexual relations that is very, very broad, uses terms that are deliberately broad to encompass a whole range of activities, using the term any person. Now, to Mr. Sullivan, any person may not mean any person, but I think to the average person of common sense, it would. So we still have this legal technical parsing over definitions and words that really leaves us precisely where we were before Mr. Craig made the promise yesterday that we would have no more technicalities and legalities to hang our hats on. And Mr. Craig, shame on you for putting together a panel here of technicalities and legalities when you promised us yesterday there'd be no more of that.
Mr. Delahunt.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I want to speak to the issues of technicalities and legalities and what have you, because I think it's important when we speak about the rule of law, oftentimes we're talking about technicalities and questionable legalities because it's embedded in our Constitution that there are certain standards and requirements. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Sullivan?
Yes, and
this is not about technicalities.
It is in response to what Mr. Barr said, and somewhat.
Mr. Sullivan, I'm just going
right,
to speak to you because I want to have
it
a
is,
little.
It is interesting to me because, in my experience, persons who make such statements, when they become the subject or the object
correct.
Of investigation, are the first ones to get the mantle of the constitutional protection.
Right, and start yelling about technicalities and legalities.
And you don't hear that kind of a speech from them anymore when they hire me to defend them. I can
right.
guarantee you that.
And this afternoon, the White House counsel Charles Ruff wrapped up the presentation of the president's defense. Again, Kwame Holman.
Charles Ruff has been lead White House counsel since January 1997. He was a Watergate prosecutor and served as United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. Ruff has used a wheelchair since contracting a paralyzing disease while working in Africa in the 1960s. Flanked by the president's private attorney, David Kendall, and White House Special Counsel Gregory Craig, Ruff delivered a one-hour statement defending the president against impeachment.
I want to begin by coming to grips directly with the issue that I think has been the principal focus of the committee's attention and concern, the president's grand jury testimony. We take this as our starting point to address the concerns off-stated by Congressman Graham and others, whether if the president were proved to have committed perjury before the grand jury, such conduct would, without more, merit impeachment. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we firmly believe, first, that the president testified truthfully before the grand jury, but second, that no matter what judgment you reach about that testimony, there could be no basis for impeachment on any reasonable reading of the constitutional standards. The Office of Independent Counsel would have the committee believe that in three respects the president committed perjury in his testimony before the grand jury. First, by stating that his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky began in February 1996 rather than November 1995. Second, by stating that he believed that a particular form of intimate activity was not covered by the definition of sexual relations approved by Judge Wright in the Jones case. And third, by stating that he had not engaged in specific types of sexual conduct, theoretically in order to conform his testimony to his civil deposition. As to the first of these, you must begin your consideration with the proposition that the president acknowledged to the grand jury that he did have a wrongful, intimate relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. What then might have led him to change by 3 months the date on which that relationship began? Well, the referral surmises, it must have been because, although the president was prepared to make the most devastating admission of misconduct any husband and father could imagine, he still wanted to have the grand jury believe that when their relationship began, Ms. Lewinsky was a 22-year-old employee rather than a 22-year-old intern. Well, putting aside for the moment the fact that under no circumstances would any reasonable prosecutor or any judge or jury find such a discrepancy material, there is absolutely no proof of any such purpose on the president's part. Not one witness, including Ms. Lewinsky, even suggested such a thing. The only proof the referral offers is a mischaracterization of the record. The contention that the president's concern about Ms. Lewinsky, about Ms. Lewinsky's badge, reflected concern about her status, that is, as an intern, rather than, as was clearly the case, her ability to move freely in the West Wing of the White House. Other than this misleading representation, we are left only with the referral's bare speculation, clearly contrived simply in order to find some fine point in the president's testimony that it could trumpet as false. As to the second of the three perjury allegations, the independent counsel would have the committee find that the president testified falsely because the independent counsel has concluded that the president's statement of his own belief in the meaning of the definition of sexual relations in the Jones case is not credible. At least here, the independent counsel is candid enough to acknowledge that he has no evidentiary basis for that conclusion. The referral simply states it to be the case and moves on. I suggest that those of you who have been prosecutors know as a matter of practical experience, and those of you who have not been prosecutors, or even lawyers, know as a matter of common sense that no one could or would ever be charged with perjury because the prosecutor did not find credible a witness's statement of his personal belief, much less his personal belief about the meaning of a definition used in a civil deposition. And so we come to the third. The referral alleges that the president lied when he admitted having one form of sexual contact with Ms. Lewinsky, but denied having certain other forms of contact, as the independent counsel would have it, in order to make his grand jury testimony consistent with the definition under which he testified in the Jones deposition. We will not drag the committee into the salacious muck that fills the referral. Instead, let each member assume that Ms. Lewinsky's version of the events is correct, and then ask, am I prepared to impeach the president because, after having admitted having engaged in egregiously wrongful conduct, he falsely described the particulars of that conduct? Let each member even assume that the president testified as he did because he did not want to admit that in a civil deposition, confronted with a narrowly, indeed oddly framed definition, he had succeeded in misleading opposing counsel, and then ask yourself, am I prepared to impeach the president for that? The answer must be no. When one scrapes away all the rhetoric, what one finds is this. The referral alleges that the president lied to a grand jury about the details of sexual conduct, not to conceal his wrongful relationship with a 22-year-old employee, but to avoid admitting that in a civil deposition, he'd misled plaintiff's counsel about an embarrassing matter that the court ultimately found immaterial. The president has said that he made no effort to be helpful, that he did not want to reveal his relationship, understandably. His answers were frequently evasive and incomplete. As my colleague, Mr. Craig, said yesterday, even maddening. They were misleading, but they were not perjurious, and a fortiori, they cannot be the basis for impeachment.
As has been the practice during the hearings, the witness then took questions from committee members.
Mr. Ruff, I want to thank you for your presentation here today. The president chose well when he chose you as his White House counsel. But let me say that I am still frustrated by what I consider to be legal arguments that don't really meet the test of common sense and human experience. When the president testified in his deposition that he had no specific recollection of ever being alone with Ms. Lewinsky, that was truthful, I just don't think meets the test of common sense and experience. I understand that's your contention, But I have to respectfully submit, and using that as an example, that it just does not stand up to analysis.
Why not just forget about these legalisms and the hair splitting and just admit to perjury or to lying under oath if that is necessary to make some editorial writers less hostile or to get a few more votes against impeachment? Why not just say it, even if it's not really perjury or lying under oath? Why is enforcing a precise legal definition of perjury important for all of our liberties?
When there is a charge that a human being committed perjury, that is, knowingly lied, it can be distinguished from testimony that may be actually truthful, evasive, misleading, but nonetheless the product of human frailty. We don't put people in jail for that, and we certainly don't impeach them. So I think the legalisms that we are legitimately accused of using, we use them, no question about it, because that's what we believe best reflects the seriousness and the gravity of the offense that the independent counsel has charged the president with committing.
You have also made the contention that this is simply about lying to cover up a personal embarrassment. But isn't it true, Mr. Ruff, that moments after the president completed that testimony before the grand jury, he went before the American people and admitted an embarrassment, which was what he acknowledges his side of what took place there? And isn't it really the reason why he committed what I think is that perjurious statement, not to avoid embarrassment, because he'd already embarrassed and disgraced himself, but for the purpose of covering up a previous lie in the testimony before the deposition in the civil case, because of the fact that if he acknowledged what Ms. Lewinsky says took place, he would be acknowledging that what he said earlier were falsehoods and that he knew they were falsehoods in that case.
I believe, I am convinced, and I think the weight of scholarly evidence would lead to the conclusion that even if you reach that conclusion, that is your conclusion, not mine, about whether the president lied or not in that deposition, in that grand jury testimony, it still doesn't warrant removing him from office. Thank you.
The gentlewoman from California, Ms. Waters.
Mr. Ruff, I too must join my colleagues in complimenting you on the job that you've done here this afternoon. I think you did a fantastic job of further taking apart, really, the allegations that we have been presented with. I don't know what else can be done with these issues. You've made it clear what the legal definitions of perjury are. We have discussed in detail obstruction of justice and bribery. The other side of the aisle, my colleagues cannot overcome the factual information that's been presented to us. As a matter of fact, the more we get into these allegations, the flimsier they are. I mean, in essence, they're rather lightweight.
White House counsel Charles Ruff completed his testimony early this evening, and the committee adjourned for the day. Tomorrow, the Republican and Democratic committee counsels will make their closing arguments. The Judiciary Committee then will begin debate on the articles of impeachment of the president.